Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Turns 25 years old. That's right, 25 years of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear in the corporate media. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. Nothing is more important to us than telling you the truth. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now and make your $25 contribution in honor of our 25th anniversary and help us stay on air for another 25 years and then another 25 after that. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We need to rally around the state. We need to rally federal support for Texans and the state of Texas. And we need to make sure that we make short and long-term policy decisions so that this kind of devastation, preventable devastation, never happens again.
Millions of Texans are still suffering after a severe winter storm caused widespread blackouts, water shortages, and dozens of deaths. We'll speak to Naomi Klein about the state's deadly decision to radically deregulate its electricity sector and why Texas Republicans fear the Green New Deal. Then we look at why some Texans are now receiving astronomically high energy bills.
I've been stuck with an $11,000 bill for 6 days of power from Gritty Energy. It's ridiculous that they stuck this amount of money on us, the working class, the middle class, all in the name of getting a profit. It makes absolutely no sense. The whole infrastructure of ERCOT and PUC needs to be regulated. It's not fair for us.
Then to the growing crisis inside prisons and jails in Texas.
Texas prisons were already in bad shape a year ago. Then COVID hit and this historic storm and power outages, and things are getting dire. The toilets are overflowing with feces. The guards say they feel like they're being held hostage and the prisoners aren't getting enough to eat.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden has signed a major disaster declaration for parts of Texas after devastating winter storms last week cut power to millions, created water shortages, left an estimated 70 people dead around the United States. In Conroe, Texas, Christian Pavon Pineda, an 11-year-old boy, died in his family's mobile home after it lost heating, like many other homes in the Houston area. His family has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Texas's power companies, which they say put profits over customers' lives. Another young victim, an 8-year-old boy from Honduras, drowned last week while attempting to cross the freezing Rio Grande from Mexico with his family. His family has reportedly returned to Mexico by U.S. border agents. Meanwhile, outrage is mounting after Texas residents were hit with skyrocketing energy bills during a massive price surge triggered by the winter weather. One man was hit with an electric bill for over $16,000. The White House said Friday the deadly winter storms delayed shipments of some 6 million coronavirus vaccines. This comes as the U.S. is poised to pass 500,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths, by far the highest death toll in the world. The number of new cases and daily deaths continue to decline, though experts warn against the relaxing of mitigation efforts, including mask wearing and physical distancing, as the threat of highly transmissible coronavirus variants remains high. In news from Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives expected to vote on the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill later this week. The package includes direct payments of $1,400 for people making up to $75,000 a year, an extension of unemployment benefits, assistance for small businesses, and money for schools, vaccine distribution, and state and local governments. It also includes a $15 an hour minimum wage increase, though Politico is reporting President Biden told a group of mayors and governors the minimum wage hike was unlikely to make it into the final bill. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is announcing an easing of coronavirus lockdown measures starting next month as the UK reports one in three adults has received a vaccine, with early data showing a slowdown in community spread. Iran has said early small-scale trials for its coronavirus vaccine, Coviran Barakat, showed 90% effectiveness. In Israel, reports emerged this weekend that officials promised to pay for a supply of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine for Syria in order to secure the release of an Israeli woman detained in Syria. In Bolivia, health workers have launched a national strike over the new health emergency law, which bans medical staff from calling strikes during the pandemic emergency period, which workers say is unconstitutional. This is a doctor from La Paz, Fernando Romero.
It is inhuman to treat this sector with such harshness, with such violence. It is an aggression by the government against our sector with this health emergency law.
A warning to our viewers, this headline contains graphic images of violence in Burma. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets today as part of a general strike against the February 1st military coup, despite threats of more deadly violence from the military junta. The massive demonstrations are taking place after two protesters were killed Saturday, including a 16-year-old, as police fired on peaceful crowds in the city of Mandalay. On Friday, a 20-year-old became the first known fatality of the protest after succumbing to her gunshot injuries from earlier this month. This is a protester speaking from Rangoon Sunday.
People died yesterday. We protested peacefully, but people had to die. The junta wants to stop us from coming out on the streets, so they strongly respond to us. We, the people, won't accept their unfair oppression, and we will continue to fight.
In Thailand, anti-government protests continued this weekend after lawmakers rejected a bid to remove the prime minister from power in a no-confidence vote. Youth-led protests have been ongoing against the government and the monarchy, demanding democratic reforms. In Ecuador, conservative banker Guillermo Lasso will advance to the second round of the presidential election against leftist economist Andrés Arauz. Indigenous candidate Yaku Perez, who came in less than half a percentage point behind Lasso, is disputing the result and has been organizing his supporters to protest and demand a recount. The next round is scheduled for April 11th. To see our recent interview with Andrés Arauz, go to democracynow.org. Britain's top court ruled Friday a group of Uber drivers should be reclassified from self-employed to company employees entitled to minimum wage, holiday pay, and other benefits. For now, the ruling only affects 25 Uber workers who sued the company in 2016. But labor rights advocates hailed the court's decision as setting a precedent for other gig economy workers. The Biden administration has reaffirmed a strategic defense partnership between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, despite the kingdom's dismal human rights record. In a phone call Friday, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin told Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman the U.S. remains committed to protecting Saudi Arabia's borders against attacks from Yemen's Houthi rebels. On Sunday, Saudi Arabia's state-owned arms manufacturer signed a deal with Lockheed Martin to form a joint venture. The deal follows Biden's decision last month to freeze U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia over its devastating war on Yemen, which has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Merrick Garland, President Biden's nominee for attorney general, is appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee today, nearly 5 years after Senate Republicans refused to hold hearings for Garland to become a justice on the Supreme Court. Garland's expected to tell lawmakers he will oversee the prosecution of white supremacists responsible for the January 6th insurrection on the U.S. Capitol. The first congressional hearings on the insurrection begin this week. Meanwhile, the confirmation of Neera Tanden to head the Office of Management and Budget is facing facing a challenge after moderate West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin said on Friday he would not vote for her. At least one Republican would have to join Democrats in order to confirm Tandon. The progressive group Roots Action is also urging senators to reject Tandon due to her ties with corporate America and her support for welfare cuts. And immigration news at the San Diego-Tijuana border. The first 25 asylum seekers who were subjected to Trump's Remain in Mexico program were allowed to enter the U.S. Friday, where their cases are being processed. Sister Diana Ortiz, the Catholic nun and outspoken opponent of torture, has died of cancer at the age of 62. In 1989, Sister Ortiz was abducted by members of Guatemala's U.S.-trained military from the compound where she worked with the poor. 24 hours later, she escaped, but within that brief period, her body had been burned with cigarettes, she'd been raped, beaten, and forced to torture a woman who was already near death. In her memoir, The Blindfold's Eye, My Journey from Torture to Truth, Sister Diana Ortiz wrote about U.S. complicity in Guatemala's repressive political system and the torture and murder of more than 150,000 Guatemalans. In 2002, she spoke with Democracy Now! In our Firehouse studio.
I really call on the American people, please do whatever you can to prevent torture from destroying and shattering more lives. Our government talks about ending the war on terrorism. Torture is a form of terrorism. So that's my plea.
And the family of civil rights icon Malcolm X is demanding authorities reopen an investigation into his assassination after new evidence was unveiled in a letter by a former police officer, Raymond Wood, who did not want the letter to be made public until after his death, wrote he was manipulated by New York police and the FBI, who covered up key details of the plot to kill Malcolm X. Wood said he was tasked with arresting members of Malcolm X's security team. This is Raymond Wood's cousin, Reggie Wood, reading the letter at a news conference Saturday, a day before the anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination in 1965.
It was my assignment to draw the two men into a felonious federal crime so that they could be arrested by the FBI and kept away from managing Malcolm X's Autobahn ballroom door security on February 21st, 1965. On February 16th, 1965, the Statue of Liberty plot was carried out, and the two men were arrested just days before the assassination of Malcolm.
That's Reggie Wood reading the words of his uncle, Raymond Wood. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan, and happy 25th anniversary of Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy, and happy 25th to you as well. My, how time flies.
Wow.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
And so much more to do. Well, today we'll start in Texas, where millions are still suffering after severe winter weather devastated the state's energy and water systems. About 8 million Texans remain under orders to boil water. About 30,000 homes still have no power. President Biden's declared a major disaster in 77 counties. Around 70 deaths have now been linked to the winter storms, mostly in Texas, including at least 12 people who died inside their homes after losing heat, including an 11-year-old boy named Christian Pavon, who froze to death in his bed in his family's mobile home in Conroe, Texas. In Sugar Land, Texas, three children and their grandmother died in a fire while trying to stay warm during the blackout. Republican lawmakers in Texas are facing increasing criticism for the handling of the crisis, as well as their decades-long push to deregulate the state's energy system. Last week, Texas Senator Ted Cruz faced outcry for flying to Cancun, Mexico, to stay at the Ritz-Carlton while millions of Texans were suffering. Cruz initially blamed the trip on his 10- and 12-year-old daughters. On Sunday, protesters brought a mariachi band to play outside his home in Houston.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Senator Greg Abbott has used the crisis as a way to attack the Green New Deal by falsely claiming the state's partial reliance on renewable energy was to blame for the blackouts.
This shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America. Texas is blessed with multiple sources of energy, such as natural gas and oil and nuclear, as well as solar and wind. But you saw from what Trace said, and that is our wind and our solar got shut down, and they were collectively more than 10% of our power grid. And that thrust Texas into a situation where it was lacking power in a statewide basis.
Meanwhile, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responded to Governor Abbott's claim by writing, quote, "The real deadly deal is his failed leadership." Over the weekend, Ocasio-Cortez traveled to Texas to help relief efforts. On Saturday, she volunteered at a food bank in Houston. So far, she's helped raise over $5 million for Texans impacted by the storms. To talk more about the crisis in Texas, we're joined by Naomi Klein, senior correspondent at The Intercept, professor at Rutgers University, along with Juan Gonzalez. She has just written a piece in The New York Times headlined, "Why Texas Republicans Fear the Green New Deal." And she is author of several books. Her most recent is the one that's coming out tomorrow, How to Change Everything, The Young Human's Guide to Protecting the Planet and Each Other. Her previous books include The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and This Changes Everything. Naomi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the Republican leadership of Texas blaming this catastrophe on what hasn't even happened yet, and that is the Green New Deal. Naomi, I think we are having trouble right now hearing you. We're going to go to a break. And then we're going to come back to you. We're just having trouble making the connection to you. Naomi Klein, senior correspondent at The Intercept, writing an op-ed piece in The New York Times. Back in a minute.
You say you like the wind blowing through your hair. Well, come on, roll with me. The sun goes down. Texas sun. Say you wanna hit the highway while the engine roars. Well, come on, roll with me till the sun goes down. The Texas sun. Caressing you from Fort Worth to Amarillo. Well, come on, roll with me to the sun dips low. Texas sun. Texas sun. Oh, girl. When I fall from home and the cold winds blow, stuck out somewhere, folks at home.
Texas Sun by Khung Vinh and Leon Bridges. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to Naomi Klein on the catastrophe that has taken place in Texas with the winter storm. About 70 deaths, it's believed. People suffering major devastation. 30,000 homes still have no power. There are still 8 million Texans under orders to boil their water. Naomi wrote a piece in The New York Times, Why Texas Republicans Fear the Green New Deal. Naomi, why?
Hi, Amy. Hi, Juan. It's good to be with you today. Yeah, it's just been a symphony of voices from the Republican Party pointing the finger at something that doesn't actually exist anywhere really, but on paper, certainly doesn't exist in Texas. Texas is about as far from a Green New Deal as you can possibly get, seeing as a Green New Deal is a plan to bring together the need to get off fossil fuels in the next decade to radically decarbonize our energy system. And as we know, fossil fuels are still king in Texas. It's a plan to marry that huge infrastructure investment in the next green economy with a plan to battle poverty, to create huge numbers of good union green jobs, to take care of people. It's a plan to have universal public health care and child care and a jobs guarantee. So it's all the things that are not happening in Texas, because there isn't just this extreme weather, which many scientists believe are linked to our warming planet. You can't link one storm with climate change, but the patterns are very clear, and this should be a wake-up call. But Texas is also suffering a pandemic of poverty, of exclusion, of racial injustice. It certainly doesn't have a Green New Deal, and we've heard this messaging, I think, because of panic, frankly, because the Green New Deal is a plan that could solve so many of Texas's problems and the problems across the country. And Republicans have absolutely nothing to offer except for more deregulation, more privatization, more austerity. And so they have been frantically seeking to deflect from the real causes of this crisis, which is an intersection of extreme weather of the kind that we are seeing more of because of climate change, intersecting with a deregulated fossil fuel based energy system. And that is the truly catastrophic intersection. And layered on that, you have all of the injustices and inequalities that mean that this doesn't impact everybody equally by any means. It's an extremely racially unjust catastrophe, as every catastrophe in the United States is.
And Naomi, could you talk a little bit about it's basically a right-wing extremism when it comes to energy policy that's been practiced in Texas. The origins of the deregulation movement that Texas pioneered, and also the other wrinkle in this, is this notorious independent streak that Texas not only wants the United States to be energy independent, the state of Texas wants to be independent from the rest of the U.S. electrical grid so that other states couldn't come to its support in this time of crisis.
Sure. In headlines, I heard you playing a clip of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's trip to Texas and the fact that she helped raise, I believe, $5 million to this point. And, you know, she's been very clear that she doesn't believe that charity is the solution to these systemic failures. And of course, she is probably the person who's most closely associated with the calls for a Green New Deal in government. But I think that what she's trying to show with this action is that government should be there to take care of people, that we should have each other's backs, particularly in a crisis. The ideology that has governed Texas now for at least four decades is an ideology, I think, best encapsulated by Ronald Reagan's famous phrase, the nine most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And, I think it is worth pausing over that because, you know, that sort of glib slogan that people should be afraid of a government that's there to help. When you have a catastrophe like the one that is unfolding in Texas, but more broadly, the pandemic everywhere, it's really quite chilling because people need a government that is there to help. And so, in Texas, they just took this to the extreme. And so it goes back further than the 1990s, but a series of fateful decisions were made in the late 1990s when Enron, blast from the past and now defunct, but the scandal plagued energy company headed by the late Ken Lay, led this successful push under then Governor George W. Bush to radically deregulate Texas's electricity sector. And they won is the bottom line. And as a result, decisions about the generation and distribution of power were stripped from regulators in Texas and handed over to private energy companies on the basis of this logic that what's good for industry will be good for everyone else. Prices will be lower. There'll be maximum competition. So you have all of these private players competing with each other. And as you said, Juan, they are quote unquote independent from the rest of the grid. You know, I see some really interesting parallels with what has happened with COVID, because when you hand over essential functions of the state to private companies, whether they're healthcare companies or whether they're energy companies, what they seek to do is make maximum profits. And you do that through, quote unquote, efficiency. Now, what does efficiency mean in practice? It means you take out all the slack in the system because you're wringing out profits, maximum profits at every turn. So when it comes to something like healthcare or elder care, that means you don't want to have a single empty hospital bed or a single empty bed in an elder care facility, because that's an inefficiency. But then if you have a shock like a pandemic, you have no slack in the system to absorb that shock, and you have disaster, right? What we've seen in Texas is something very similar with energy, right? There's no slack in the system. There's no built-in redundancies, because if you're plugged into the national grid, if you have a shock in your state or in one location, then energy from somewhere else that is not having a shock is able to come in and cover for you. In Texas, they took out all of those redundancies. And so then you have a weather shock that puts stress on the system, knocks out capacity, and also there's a surge in demand because it's freezing and everybody wants more energy, and it just blows the whole system out in the same way that the pandemic blew out any capacity in the healthcare system, if that makes sense. So unsurprisingly, these private companies prioritize short-term profit over costly investments in maintaining the grid, in winterizing the grid for an extreme event. They took out all the built-in redundancies. And today, Texans are at the mercy of regulation-allergic politicians who failed to require that energy companies plan for shocks like the one they're experiencing right now, and like the ones, frankly, we are going to see more and more of because of our destabilized climate.
And Naomi, as you've often documented, every crisis brings an opportunity for other capitalists to profit. Who will benefit from this crisis? Can you talk about the shale gas company, for instance, Comstock Resources?
Right. Yeah. Look, energy companies are it's a windfall as they are proudly telling their investors. Comstock Resources is a shale gas company, and on an earnings call last Wednesday, their chief financial officer said, this week is like hitting the jackpot with some of these incredible prices, because once again, there are no protections for consumers. So all of this was sold to Texans based on this idea that it was going to lower their energy costs. But there's no protections from costs going up when you have a huge surge in demand like they're experiencing right now. So people who were fortunate enough not to lose their power, and I know you're going to be talking about this more later on in the show, but people who had their power stay on are now being hit with these absolutely exorbitant electricity bills. Once again, no protections for them, because it's a market free for all, which was the vision from the start. And so you have politicians like Ted Cruz now, you know, banging their hands on the table saying, this is wrong. What is it? What are these huge bills? It's entirely legal. This is the result of the energy system that they built.
So, Naomi, you have the former governor, Rick Perry, who is also the Secretary of Energy of the United States, retweeting an article saying, quote, if we humans want to keep surviving frigid winters, we're going to have to keep burning natural gas and lots of it for decades to come. He also went on to say Texans would be without electricity for longer than 3 days to keep the federal government out of their business. I don't know if that's why Senator Cruz fled to Mexico to keep the federal government out of Texas. But this moment where you have this older, white, wealthy Republican leadership of Texas, deregulation going back to the 30s, right? I mean, for people to understand, you've got the Eastern grid, the Western grid, and Texas. That's what you have, the electric grids in the United States. And El Paso was not a part of the Texas independent grid, and so they did so much better. But what this means for that leadership and the young leadership that has been fighting for a Green New Deal, that has been recognizing COVID as a scientific reality that Texas was disastrous in dealing with.
Sure. I mean, there's a very strong youth-led movement in Texas that has been calling for a Green New Deal for a while. And I think that they're going to be calling for that with greater confidence and greater volume and greater determination in the weeks and months to come, which is why, you know, in the New York Times piece that you mentioned, I described all of this deflection as a form of panic, because we know that they know, and we know, that they have no solutions for the problems that they have created. All they have to offer Texans is more deregulation, more privatization, more austerity, more disaster capitalism. As usual, we're seeing waves of criminalizing people who protest against fossil fuel companies. They don't have solutions to real problems, which is why they're just making things up. And we're seeing that on absolutely every level. I want to come back to, you know, what you were saying about this this rift between the leadership who really don't have to worry about their power, are taking vacations in the middle of this, are clearly not worried, are making these glib statements like, oh, yeah, you know, we'll live without power for much longer if necessary. They're not the ones without power. Right. There's so much inequality, as I said earlier, whenever there is any kind of disaster in the United States, it follows racial fault lines, economic fault lines. And I think that we should think about Ted Cruz's ill-fated trip to Mexico, not as a quote-unquote mistake, as he now describes it, but in a way as a metaphor, Amy, a metaphor for how these politicians actually think about the climate crisis. They don't think it's a hoax. They just say that publicly. They know it is real. You know, these are people with deep ties to the oil and gas industry. And the oil and gas industry is in lots of ways benefiting from the climate crisis, because there's melting in the Arctic. It's opening up it's opening up trade routes because of that. They're having to adapt all kinds of their own infrastructure to deal with the reality of climate change. They don't really genuinely believe that it isn't real. They're on the front lines of it in lots of ways. What they believe, and I think we've talked about this before on the show, is that this is somebody else's problem. They believe that their wealth, their power, and their privilege will protect them from the worst of its effects. And if we want to know what that looks like, it looks like Ted Cruz boarding a flight to Mexico in the middle of a disaster to go to the Ritz-Carlton in Cancun. And that is something that I've tracked, you know, over the years, in this privatized response to crisis, right? So it isn't just the systematic neglect and deregulation of the private sphere, of the infrastructure that regular people, everyday people have to depend on in a crisis. It's that they're simultaneously building their privatized kind of rescue bubbles. You know, there was a short-lived airline that I wrote about in the Shock Doctrine many years ago, short-lived because it was ahead of its time. It was called HelpJet. It was launched in Florida, and it was a private jet airline that would that would send a notice to people in Florida when their beachfront homes were at risk from a hurricane. And their slogan was something like, turn a disaster into a luxury vacation. This company would send a limousine to come pick you up, take you to the airport, and jet you out on a private jet, make your reservations at a luxury resort. And that was their idea of how to deal with a disaster. Now in California, when there are wildfires, there are private firefighters that come to protect the mansions and the wineries. So they don't see themselves as part of the public infrastructure that they're systematically allowing to degrade. They believe they'll be fine. What does that look like? It looks like Ted Cruz flying off to Mexico. Now, he got caught. He's calling it a mistake. It's actually a metaphor for the fact that they don't believe they have to deal with the effects of the disasters that they themselves are creating.
And Naomi, if we could, the Biden administration, I'm wondering if you could give us a brief take on how it's been responding to this crisis and also in the initial in its initial weeks in terms of its climate policy.
You know, I think that there are obviously some good signs when it comes to climate policy, the canceling of the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, I think most significantly, we are seeing much more coordination between different arms of the government. And this has been something that's really been lacking in previous administrations, where climate has just been treated as a narrow pollution issue that should be dealt with by the EPA and the Energy Department. And I think one of the most significant things is this sort of commitment to having individuals whose job it is to make sure that all the different arms of the government, all the different departments and agencies are talking to each other. But there, you know, Keystone needs to be more than just one pipeline canceled. It needs to be a principle. And the principle is we cannot be building new fossil fuel infrastructure. I know you've covered the intense battles against Line 3, against the Dakota Access Pipeline. All of this new fossil fuel infrastructure needs to be canceled. We cannot be locking in new fossil fuel infrastructure when we need to be winding down if we're going to get off fossil fuels in a decade, which is what scientists have told us we need to do. So there are some good signs, but unfortunately, we're still at the level of symbolism. We are not at the level of actually doing what is necessary to prevent the kind of catastrophic warming that we can't survive. We're already in the era of climate shocks, of climate disasters. But if we don't get off the road we are on, if we don't swerve, then we're going to be dealing with shocks that we can't adapt to. I think we need to be talking about whether energy belongs in private hands at all, whether this is just too much of an essential service, and also whether we just need too much change too quickly to have the private sector involved in energy in the first place. And these are the sorts of policy discussions that the Biden administration, because of its ties to the private sector, is really not willing to engage in yet. But they're going to be under huge pressure, I think, particularly after this, by the progressive wing of the party, by outside climate justice movements. And we'll see what happens, because they've already moved a lot more than they've wanted to move. Biden is doing more than than his campaign was promising, certainly in the early days. So we'll see. They are under pressure. They have moved, and they're going to need to move further.
And Naomi, we only have 30 seconds, but of course, the youngest are also such extreme victims of this catastrophe. We learned about 11-year-old Christian, who went outside, saw snow for the first time to play in the snow, came inside and froze to death. We hear these stories as part of the 70 people who have died as a result of the storm. You have a book that's coming out tomorrow. Tonight, you'll be doing a big virtual event with Sunrise Movement at the Brooklyn Public Library. Your book, How to Change Everything, The Young Human's Guide to Protecting the Planet and Each Other. Your final thoughts on why you wrote this book.
Thank you, Amy. At this event tonight, we'll also be joined by Takata Iron Eyes, who is a young woman who is from Standing Rock and was one of the young people who helped start that incredible movement in Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and is just one example of the fact that young people now, and by young people, I'm not just talking about university students, I'm talking about middle school students and high school students, are truly the heart and soul of the climate movement right now. And that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book for this incredible generation who have been leading climate strikes, who have been pushing politicians, speaking truth in incredible ways, like Greta, who you've talked about so much on the show, but is part of this amazing generation of millions of young people around the world. There aren't a lot of books that take them seriously, that treat them with the dignity to believe and understand that they're ready for the truth because they're living it, and they need some tools, some intellectual tools, some facts, some figures, to fight for the future that they deserve. So that's why I wrote the book. And I'm so excited to have these opportunities to interview young people about why they have built this amazing movement. And that's what we're going to be doing tonight and over the next few weeks.
Naomi Klein, senior correspondent at The Intercept, professor at Rutgers University. We'll link to your New York Times op-ed piece, the headlined Why Texas Republicans Fear the Green New Deal. Her latest book is coming out tomorrow. It's titled How to Change Everything, The Young Human's Guide to Protecting the Planet and Each Other. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. While millions of Texans lost power last week, some of those who are fortunate to keep their lights on are now facing a shocking surprise, astronomically high energy bills. Some have been charged up to $16,000 for just a few days of energy use. On Sunday, Governor Abbott ordered a moratorium on disconnecting power to customers who cannot pay these bills. The skyrocketing bills are a result of the state's move to radically deregulate the energy grid. Some consumers purchase electricity plans with rates that fluctuate with the market. We're joined now by two guests. First, we go to Akilah Scott Amos, who is a Texas resident who saw her electricity bill jump over $11,000 during the storm. Akilah, tell us what happened.
Hi. Thank you guys for having me. So I woke up on Sunday to various debits being taken out of my account in $100 increments, because that's what I have it set at. And when I went on the Facebook page, I'm with Gritty Energy, and they are very active on Facebook. So when I went on there, they were telling everyone to switch providers immediately. So the first thing that I did actually was give them a call, because I didn't understand why my bill was negative $456. And they told me that the price of energy is going up and that I had two options. The first option, of course, was to switch. And the second option was to just turn my power off totally and go to a hotel. Option one, of course, I did call. I called around to several energy companies, and they were either not taking new clients or the switch date couldn't happen until the 22nd. So I really had no choice there. I did sign up for the 22nd, but there was nothing else I could do as far as actually turning the power off at our home and going to a hotel. That absolutely was not an option. Leaving our home unprotected, that just wasn't going to work. We also have a very big dog. I have two children getting over a cold. We are still in a pandemic, so leaving the house just wasn't an option. As the days went on, my bill got higher. The next day it was $2,500. The next day it was the same amount. We pulled back on our energy use. We don't use that much anyway to begin with. So, we weren't using lights. Our heat is gas, but of course it uses electricity to blow. We had our electricity on 62 through the house. We used our gas fireplace. And of course we use, the internet and to keep our phones and tablets charged. But other than that, we decreased our use significantly. But I saw a big jump in our kilowatt usage, which definitely isn't accurate. And again, I got hit with $2,500 a day. And so now my bill is a little over $11,000.
We're also joined by Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen. Tyson, could you tell us this whole issue of deregulation, what's happened in Texas and these sky high bills? What's your take on it?
Yeah, it's totally unacceptable. And while clearly some individual energy companies bear responsibility, ultimately, it's state officials and regulators who just did a terrible job allowing these types of predatory utility pricing plans to be even offered to residential households in the first place. We have to remember that for the first 100 years of our electricity system, federal law states that electricity is affected with a public interest. And that's why we call them public utilities. Naomi was doing a great job earlier talking about the significant public interest responsibilities that electricity provides. It literally is life or death. And in Texas, and Texas isn't alone here, we've had a huge radical shift in the oversight of electricity markets away from regulatory protections to protect people and ensure reliability, and instead a reliance on market forces. And Texas is the clearest case of this, where instead of enforcing mandatory reliability standards for owners of power plants, Texas instead relies on huge price increases to incentivize power generators to deliver electricity even during perilous times like winter ice storms. And so what we saw was, as prices spiked to $9,000 a megawatt hour, which is just astronomical, a typical price could be around $20 a megawatt hour, there were thousands of Texans that signed up for retail rate programs that were directly tethered to the wholesale price. And during most times when power prices are normal, many of these customers saw some bill savings. And that's the way that the companies marketed these plans to households. But then, of course, when prices spiked, these companies simply passed on those extremely high prices onto their customers. And so the real question here is, what on earth were regulators thinking in allowing households to sign up for these types of predatory plans? We've seen this with credit cards and with payday lenders and with home mortgages. Energy is the same type of thing where we are seeing in these deregulated environments unscrupulous companies preying on their assumption that households will not understand or read the fine print. And it's unreasonable to expect people to understand what's going to be happening with wholesale prices. Sophisticated Wall Street energy traders wouldn't even sign up their own families for this type of plan because they understand the risk. So I think first and foremost, as we move forward to try to understand how all this happened, the first thing that Texas needs to do is to ban these types of predatory practices so that households are not exposed to these high prices. I think the second thing we need to do.
Tyson, if I can, I just want to bring Akilah Scott-Amos into the conversation again. Akilah, what did you know about the ways that these prices could go up, and this whole system of them taking money out of your accounts, not at the end of the month, but apparently on a rolling basis?
Right. I understood how a wholesale scenario works, and I understand that it works well in a stable market, and the market here has been stable. Because, you know, they're in charge. And so they should definitely have some type of stop loss trigger in there, the same way that they do with anything else, so that for short term, so that we, you know, don't get hit on the short end of the stick. It's just not right. They failed.
Jimmy has, does this mean you won't have to pay, or they're just putting off your payment? They won't cut off your electricity or your energy.
For right now, it means that I don't have to pay right now. They're not going to cut me off, but we will see how long that goes. I know Governor Abbott is talking with ERCOT in order to arrange something, but I mean, I don't have any problems with paying. I have no problems with paying my fair share, but this is not fair.
Wow. Akilah Scott-Amos, I want to thank you for being with us. We would have said you were one of the lucky Texans who didn't lose electricity, but instead your electricity bill jumped almost $5,000 overnight. And Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program, thanks so much for being with us. When we come back, we look at what happened in Texas's prisons and jails. Stay with us. Love. Dark was the night, cold was the ground by Blind Willie Johnson. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we look now at the dire conditions incarcerated people in Texas faced as they were left for days in their cells, often with no heat or running water during last week's winter storm that overwhelmed Texas's deregulated energy grid. At the Federal Medical Center Carswell, Fort Worth Star-Telegram reporter Kaylee Johnson reported more than 1,000 women held there finally got heat Friday after nearly 6 days of freezing, though the Bureau of Prisons disputed this. One prisoner told The Intercept sewage water was everywhere in the facility, which has also been hit hard by COVID-19 and houses whistleblower Reality Winner, who tested positive for COVID in July. Reports are also emerging from immigrant jails of solitary confinement cells with no heat. Texans locked up in city and county jails, accused of crimes but awaiting trial, unable to post bond, also suffered. This is Brandy S., who's jailed in Bowie County, describing conditions there in a call recorded Thursday by the Texas Jail Project.
We're not receiving any tissue. I'm in a pod of 19 women that came up here. Yesterday, well, haven't given us any soap since 2 weeks ago almost. Laundry has not came at all, and we're completely out of pads. We've had water, but the heat in our particular dorm has been out for days. The only way that we are regulating our temperature is the dorms that are beside us. Their heat, I guess, is working, and it's like filtering over through the bars into ours, but it has been cold. They give us two blankets when we get here, but they have not offered us any extra blankets since the weather has hit.
That was Brandy S., jailed in Bowie County. In Houston at the Harris County Jail, the third largest jail in the United States, at least one man was reported dead last week as men shivered in overcrowded cells, many sleeping on the floor next to overflowing toilets. Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez described the jail last month as, quote, bursting at the seams. And this was last month, before the storm. He'd already warned of a potential health crisis. Across Texas, officials said 33 prisons lost power, 20 had water shortages. For an update on all of this, we go to Houston, where we're joined by Kerry Blakinger, staff writer for the Marshall Project, the publication's first formerly incarcerated reporter. Her latest piece is headlined, Inside Frigid Texas Prisons, Broken Toilets, Disgusting Food, Few Blankets. In it, she shows several photos of the kind of food prisoners have been forced to eat and describes the, quote, increasingly pitiful meals, including one that was nothing but a small piece of cornbread, a half a piece of cheese, a handful of raisins, and a hot dog with no bun or ketchup. Kerry, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe what took place over this last week.
Well, Texas prison conditions have gone from bad to pretty dire, I would say, in dozens of units. For some prisoners, I think this is a little bit like Harvey all over again, but the problems are probably more, well, definitely more widespread this time. You know, in once the power started going out in the free world, we started seeing this happening in prisons as well. Prisons didn't really have the sort of infrastructure going into all of this that many people do in the free world. So we're seeing places that already had trouble heating things adequately. You know, there's been longstanding issues with a lack of air conditioning in the summers. And every winter we hear these same complaints about lack of heat or a very uneven heat. Because in a lot of cases, even if the heat is working, the ductwork is shoddy and old. So it simply just doesn't get anywhere. And that's all before a storm. So then you have a storm, you lose electricity in several units, you lose water or water pressure in several units, you have overflowing toilets, you have, you know, I was hearing reports of units where they have four toilets to 100 and some men, and on a good day that's not enough, and then those toilets don't work, and, you know, the conditions get bad pretty quickly. We heard about men taking snow from the roofs to try to flush the toilets, but of course there's just not enough snow to deal with thousands of men. And then, you know, there's the food on top of that. As you mentioned, I've gotten some pictures of what the meals look like. And, you know, they're clearly just not enough to support grown people. And these are meals that are not your daily prison fare. This is what happens when there are lockdowns, because the food tends to get worse during lockdowns. They're given bagged meals. And, you know, when there's not enough staff to help coordinate these things, these bagged meals end up looking sadder and sadder. And it's just clearly not adequate.
And Carrie, what kind of oversight or minimum requirements are there by state officials on these prisons? For instance, are there any requirements for them to have emergency generators or backup systems in case of power failures?
I don't know if there's a legal requirement for it. There's not as much oversight in some ways regarding prisons as there are regarding jails. The oversight for prisons just sort of falls to the agency and to state legislators. But the fact of the matter is that we have roughly 100 prisons, and that is expensive. So we have, you know, we have a lot of infrastructure and equipment problems. We don't have working fire alarms in most prisons. Like, when we do have generators, which, you know, they do have generators, they don't always go on as planned. And even if they do, the ductwork is problematic at best. So it's not so much that these things don't exist, it's that they're often just not functional.
And in terms of the situation in county jails, are you familiar or have a sense of what's been going on there?
Yeah, so in Harris County, which is where I live, this is the, you know, biggest jail. There's about 9,000 people in the jail there. You know, we're hearing a lot of these same, you know, fairly dire complaints. But here, I think it's worth noting that the sheriff has been, you know, has been out and saying that this jail was going to be a problem. Like, he has been trying to get the population reduced and has been, you know, has been having issues with the judges and the state and prosecutors, trying to work with them or, you know, work against them, whatever the case may be.
I mean, he sued, didn't he, Carrie? He sued to get the population reduced, the sheriff.
He's been vocal about this before COVID and during COVID. And, you know, I think he'd be the first to say that, well, he has been the first to say that this is a problem. And, you know, one thing also about the jail here is that they actually managed to get some people vaccinated as a result of this, which I thought was, I would say a silver lining, but it's such a bad situation. I hate to say that. But they actually managed to get around 900 people vaccinated with vaccines that would have gone bad because of the loss of refrigeration when electricity went out elsewhere. So that's something that I haven't heard happening else in other jails or prisons, people getting vaccinated as a result of the power outages. But, you know, I think it does show sort of where the sheriff's where the sheriff's interests lie in terms of advocating for the people in his jail.
Is it true? We heard Carswell, the federal prison where Reality Winner is, they actually didn't lose electricity, but didn't want to turn on the heat so that it wouldn't be said that only prisoners get heat in Texas.
I haven't gotten any indication that that was true. You know, I've heard plenty of complaints about the conditions that I've talked to, you know, families and friends and lawyers of people who were in there. You know, the thing is, if you turn off the heat, the staff has an incentive not to turn off the heat because then they have to work in those conditions. What I have heard is that it took a while for the heat to, you know, be functional enough to make much difference, and that there were places in the facility where the conditions varied quite a lot. Like, some places in the facility had longer power outages than others. So I haven't gotten any confirmation about that.
Carrie Blankenship, we want to thank you for being with us and for your reporting with the Marshall Project. We will link to your latest piece, Inside Frigid Texas Prisons, Broken Toilets, Disgusting Food, Few Blankets. And tune in tomorrow, Democracy Now!, as we remember the pioneering science fiction writer Octavia Butler, who died 15 years ago this week. She gave one of her last interviews to Democracy Now! In 2005. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.